Aleph.
We are at Daf Ayin Tet, and we're holding three lines up from the bottom of Ayin Chet Amud Bet.
Right.
Exactly. Ayin Tet. Wonderful. Can you please give us the medical report of an Ayin Tov today? Ahi itata. The boy the tavrechino nichsa migavra. There was a certain woman who was getting married and who did not want her husband to come ahead now and take her property as part of the deal of the marriage. And she was basically an amah now, had been married before, she already had grown children, and she wasn't exactly ready to give over everything to a new husband. So she she didn't make a prenuptial agreement. Instead, she did a classic tax candidate, in which she transferred the property to her daughter. Pretended it was her daughter's property, and then the husband couldn't get it. So she writes out the shtar, and Katrina Barta, she writes out a shtar like this to her daughter, and she makes it clear that she doesn't really mean this to be a real gift. According to Rashi, she actually says it to Aiden, which is a problem later on in the sugya, as Tosis points out. The Tosis just serves as the re-explains that it's an undana, so that this is what's happened. She didn't mean to give away her property to her daughter, but it was in the context of the marriage. If she ends up now losing her husband, either through divorce or death, that the daughter will return the property to her. That was the understanding. Anyway, in Siva, she goes and gets married, and then she gets a divorce. And as often happens in these situations, her daughter says, Baba, Mommy, you gave it to me, exactly. But she doesn't want to give the property back. Momish contemporary issues over here. So the mother sues the daughter. So I tell you, coming to Reb Nachman, when they come to Reb Nachman, Reb Nachman asks to see the shtar. He looks at the shtar and he tears it up.
Meaning against the mother.
No, against the daughter. Also, Rav Anna was really upset by this. Rav Anna goes to Marukva. Marukva was the dying there, as we saw earlier. Omar Lay, he says, you know, this guy, he's gone off his rockers, like the Supreme Court of Israel. Nachman Chaklo, Nachman the farmer. I mean, he's obviously not a judge. He's a redneck. A redneck, he goes on tearing things up. Somebody brings him a shtar, tears it up. I don't understand. This guy, you call a judge. He should be thrown out. Omar Lay, so Rav Anna said, so Rav Baruch said to Rav Anna, easy go for the day. How? Let's hear easy. Like what exactly went on? This lesson of easy is not so clear. I mean, it actually translates into easy, but precisely what it means is not clear. As Rashbam says, it means lesson of eifo. There, it's just one of these words that means.
Exactly.
No, eifo with an aleph. There, you know, sort of therefore. Like, it's just an expression. Me eifo. What is that supposed to be? Me eifo. So who then? Who therefore, who thus, that type of thing. It's not easy, it's a type of a folk. Others learn easy as a lotion of Yedidus. It's a word for a hobby. My friend. It definitely means easy. It has that same sense of easy, like tell me over the details, calmly, you're coming in here all hot under the collar, let me get the details. It's interesting that the Chofetz Chaim actually brings this particular maisa as an indication that whenever there's something to be mavar, here you're talking about Ravanan. Ravanan was zeichet the gilui elio. He's not a small guy. He comes and tells Maruf for something. You think that Maruf would have a right to immediately react? Hey, Ravanan said, no. Let's see the details. Could very well be that it's different than the way you're reporting it. And so he tells him, now we're talking about something different. Shtar mavrachet kamer. You're talking about a shtar that is written only for the purpose of keeping away the taxman, or only for the purpose of keeping away somebody who wants to collect the chol, or somebody, in this case, a husband. But it's not meant as a real shtar. Then he was perfectly correct to tear that shtar up. Because you should know that I am, and the correct yourself, you're almost 100% is me, your ehora'am. I'm a person who's very careful. I don't get very, very aggressive with ehora'as. I take it very carefully. I'm your ehora'am. But nonetheless, I'm telling you that in Yavosh Shtar Mavrachat Liyadi Akra'ena. I saw such a shtar would tear it up. So Reb Nachman was doing exactly what a dayan should do. When something wrong, a shtar that's unenforceable, and that may be presented before a Bezdin Tayim, and the Chlal could be used in all kinds of funny ways, comes before a court, it's the court's responsibility to get rid of invalid financial instruments. And that's exactly what Reb Nachman did. They have nothing to complain about. Or Mele Rabbele Reb Nachman. So Rabbi Tanya to Reb Nachman, that still doesn't add up to me. Why did you tear up the shtar? Time of mind. Because basically, you're taking for granted that this was not a shtar that the mother meant to give to the daughter, because a person doesn't give away the nechasim. It's clear that indeed this was meant only as a shtar mavracha. Now this is the problem with Rashi. If it's talking about that she was modia to Aden, if this is the case, that we should bring forth the Aden, why are we talking about an umdana over here? Okay, I mean, obviously the other issue over here is whether this wasn't begetter and beidah mamish, the shtar is invalid. So it's a gilui of das. So, I mean, we need to see something in the nature of the shtar that could tell us that the shtar is ipso facto, that type of shtar. In other words, we have an umdana, a shtar that says, I give away my property to you, is ipso facto, something's funny about it. And it must be that we're going to have to find out the context. Okay, so the moment we look at the context, we understand what happened. The IRS was banging at the door. We needed to show that this wasn't my property. So we show it's not my property. That is sufficient to make the shtar the equivalent of a shtar pasim. Get rid of it. So, but the problem is, said Rav Nachman, this is her daughter. You're applying a halacha that is said in general. Obviously, a person who gives away his nechassim, something's funny. But a woman who gives away her nechassim to her daughter, I mean, so maybe she means to give away her nechassim to her daughter. I mean, she doesn't like her daughter. So why should we necessarily assume that it's a fact of, I mean, a prima facie is what I mean, that the shtar is no good. It should be fine. Said Rav Nachman to him, "Abba Barta Yaiva." It's only to other people, to her daughter, she would give. Said Rav Nachman to him, "Afilu Achi, b'mokam Barta nafsha atifa." Even so, and it's b'mokam Barta, a person cares about themselves and doesn't give away their own things to their children as long as they need them. Meisvei harotzeh shetavriach mechaseh harotzeh shetavriach mechaseh mibala keitzad yosa. Somebody who now wants to make sure that a husband doesn't get hold of her property, what should she do? So she should write a shtar pasim as lashon of the pius, in which the shtar is written only to look like something, and then she's mafayes, the person who's getting the shtar, that they should act with it as if it's theirs, but understand that it isn't really there. I mean, the original, this is sort of like a shtar pasim that we had before. The union is to make a person look as if he's got money coming in and so on. But those kind of shtaras are actually usher to write. Over here, it's not mamish an isser. So that's so says Rishon Yomiyot. Chachomim omrim. Chachomim say, you write a shtar like that, it's all very nice. But you could be the finest guy from today till tomorrow. But Ratzam Mitzakeipa. He can just laugh at her and wave goodbye, walk off with the property. I mean, pretend to be willing to take it on that basis, and in the end walk off with the property. So what does it say in the shtar? That it's not mine. So it would be a rather dangerous thing to do. She would have to write in it, it's mine, basically, that would say, it's yours, when I so wish it to be yours. Right? So this is even better than Shonim, so this is even better than saying an almanat. Because almanat, lemaitz, we end up asking that we need to have a tenaikot, like they got a meruven. But likisha erze means not that it's chal now, but on condition. So in other words, it hasn't happened yet. If that's the case, it's certainly not really a matana until she says, I want you to have it. But taima, because for the office, it's only because you write in that way. But halo kasvalahachi kananani lokeach. If you wouldn't have written in that way, so lokeach indeed gets it. So then if that's the case, and it turns out that what we just said over here, that it's considered to be a good etzah to do it this way, and that's what Shmuel was quoted by Rav Naloi Baridi, I would tear it up. Why would he tear it up? This is a perfectly good shtar. Because it didn't say that Kisher had said, so there's nothing wrong with it that he should tear it up. Well, you say because the person had an intent, so therefore I tear up the shtar, that is the etzah, a valid shtar, that the person, if he wants to, could be mitzachet, use the shtar to walk off the property. So I'm now the moral arbiter to say that's not nice. And tear up the shtar, it's not an invalid instrument, it's a valid instrument. So why did Shmuel say that it would be a good idea to tear up? And explain that. Omre mizera, lokasha, habakula habamiktata. You have to understand that all that Shmuel meant when he said that you're not kaina and that the shtar should be torn up is where it's prima facie, not a kosher shtar. That is not true when you start to give a gift. Obviously, a mother could give a gift, anybody could give a gift. But where you're giving away everything you own. Giving away everything that you own. Then says Shmuel, that is prima facie meant to be understood in context. Was the tax man there? Was there a bachov? There's something's funny. He said that type of thing, but that's not how the case over here was referring to when we said that it could be mitzachekba. Shmuel is minded to. If he didn't write the whole thing, and in that case, there's no reason to say maybe it's not really a gift. So then, of course, Shmuel would never have said to tear up such a shtar. The iloka nani lokeach. Wait. So let me understand this thing.
Is it a language of everything, or is it happens to be that this property was
either way? Either way. So let me understand what you're saying. You're saying that the lokeach is not kaina, according to Shmuel, and it's talking about where she gave away the whole thing, right? So then, I mean, if that's the case, you're saying there was no real kinyan here at all. The meaning of a prima facie possible shtar is that nothing happened. That's what you're saying. Nothing happened because we clearly could see that the shtar was not meant to give over anything. So then, there's no habracha? Where's the habracha? So then the husband should get it. I mean, you can't have it both ways. If you're going to give away everything, so then by definition you're not being mavriya. If you're giving away something, so then he can laugh at you and walk away. So how exactly do we understand, according to Shmuel, that this is a way to be mavriach? He's not being mavriach at all. It says the Gemara, since Lamaisa, it remains over here, a shtar. In other words, let's say the husband hadn't known that there was these nechassim. It's possible to have nechassim that the husband should not be zechen. Not zechen, because he doesn't know about it. And since the whole inyan of giving nechassim was connected pidyon, if he doesn't know about it, he's not going to claim that this is where you should be able to pay your pidyon. So if that's the case, he basically was marrying her on condition that this would remain hers, so to speak. Because he had no idea that it was hers. Therefore, it works as a bracha. It's not the same as saying nothing was accomplished. It was accomplished. You're saying that it sort of oscillates. But you write such a star, even if you write the Kisha Eretz said. That too would be sort of odd. If it's mine, so then it's not mine. But if it's not mine, then it is mine. That's what's happening. The moment that it's mine, you try to take it, I want to give it away. But the moment that I give it away and the other person would take it, then I want to take it to myself. Okay, so that basically they made it like the chasim shein are you doing, because on the surface it appears to be given away. So there is, it's not as if it's an all or nothing black and white issue. It's not as if a woman owns something, so by definition the Baal owns it. That's not true. Because we see how leave it to Rabbi Shimon, even when a woman owns something, it's not necessarily so that the husband owns it. What is the chasim shein are you doing? So then she'd be able to go and be meicher. I, her husband, owns it. So it's not across the board transference of ownership to husband. If that's the case, so then there's nothing that stands against the logic of saying that these are the nechassim that remain hers, even though the husband doesn't, even though she hasn't really given it away to anybody else. We know you're on the way. Naflu na kesafim. So now we've been talking about where property falls to us. Okay, what happens with that property? Can she sell the property? And so she sells the property, and then she ends up with cash. So that cash, obviously, we're not going to be able to tell her its dispensation. How about if what she got after the nisuin was cash? Now obviously, cash is not considered to be the equivalent of the nifseimu that the husband is able to eat, because cash, if I spend it, does not reappear. This is a lesson that is painfully learned in life.
It's gone. It's gone.
It's gone. So that means that the baal, by definition, can't be zocher in cash. Because the whole point of nichsei malug is that the keren remains to the woman, and now what's generated by the keren is given to the husband. But he certainly can't spend cash. Because then he's spent, that's something else. It's what do we do? How do we get injured? So you could say that the husband says, look, you know, you got a fat bank account, let's invest in stocks. She doesn't like that idea too much. She's heard about losing her. Exactly. So what do you do? Says the mission, Noflula Ksafim, Yilakach Behem Kark. Basically, I mean, obviously, if she wants to invest in a business, because it's, hey, but the only thing that he can force to be done with this money is that it should have a Karen that is not Kalya, that isn't used up. So then that means he has to buy real estate. And then he can work the real estate and generate profit with the real estate. Now, suppose at the time of the marriage, this is a curious question. We say the husband eats payroll. I mean, is that just the things that were generated by the money that he invested, or in the carbon that he invested in? So it means he has the right to use this keren to generate money. But what would happen if at the time that they get married, there are payroll on the property? So are those payroll actually, is that part of the property? And now we have to get payroll of those payroll, because those payroll are the equivalent to cash, but he didn't generate those payroll. Or when we say the husband eats payroll, it means that we separate between the karka, which we view as the keren, and that which the karka produces, whether it was produced by him or produced by anybody else. So it's really strange. And if Lamaisa, she would bring into the marriage a barrel full of oranges, I mean, that's cash. It's obviously not payroll. If she brings in karka without perot, and obviously he would have to work the karka to get the perot. But what happens if she brings in karka that already has perot? So is this an actual, is perot an abstraction? Or is perot an actual schus that we give to the husband as against the keren? We view the keren as the karka, and then even if it's already there, it doesn't mean he had to generate. So this is the Mishnah's next question. Turns out that it's a machlokas. So now, suppose she brings in perot hatushim min hakarka. So of course, if she brings in a bushel of perot, so that's cash. So we sell those perot and we buy real estate and then he eats the perot. Certainly in that case, perot is not an abstraction. Perot is just a form of shavah kesef. And that's for sure. How about perot hamechubarim b'karka? How about if the field that she brings into the marriage already has perot on it? Well, Rabbi Meir, well, what's that supposed to mean? What perot? A perot is just another form of the keren that she's bringing in. If she brought in cash, so we would buy karka. So because it happens to be karka, so now the perot is suddenly perot. These perot are basically a different form of karka, not a different form of perot. So we're going to look at the value that these perot have added to the property, add that value. Let's say the property without the perot was worth $100,000. With the perot, it's worth $120,000. Okay, so that means that the Baal just got a property worth $120,000. It's more capital. Okay, so then that's the same as inheriting cash from his wife. Okay, so if she brought in $20,000 besides a field worth $100,000, what would we do with the $20,000? We'd buy more land and add it to this land, and now we have $120,000 worth of land. That's what you got to do. So shamino to kame yafa beperot, bekame yafa below perot, umotar yivakak bem karkavu ochel perot. I mean, why not, says Rabbi Meir? You take a look at the difference in the value between the property with or without perot, and that difference is invested by the husband in a piece of property after he sells the perot, and then you can start generating perot, but he's certainly not going to get to keep the perot. V'chachamim omrim ha-mechubarim lekarka shalo. If they're mechubar lekarka, they are not cash. They are perot of karka that he inherited. He doesn't have to be the one that did all the work on the karka to get the perot. That was the takana. That we separate between v'chachamim omrim ha-mechubarim lekarka shalo v'atloshim min ha-karka shala v'yelakach v'en karka v'ochel perot. If it's mechubar lekarka, so then it's considered to be perot of this karka. If it was already tolushim in a karka, so then fine, then it belongs indeed to her, that's for sure, because then it's the equivalent of just because she's also bringing in karka, and she's bringing it separately, the perot that this karka generated, that for sure related to you, that's not given to the husband, and therefore, yelakach b'em karka, v'ochel perot. So the question over here is why, who do they belong to?
You can eat the perot.
Who do they belong? How about next year when the karka produces perot? Who gets the perot? Exactly. So why should we say this year he doesn't? What, because he didn't put in enough work? Where does it say that it's only where he makes the work? That's what the Chachamim are saying. He can eat it immediately. Until the time that it's actually Shava Kesev and not the Perot of Karka. It's only once it's harvested that it loses its identity as Perot of this Karka. That becomes just an abstraction cash. It's just cash. But as long as it's the produce of this property, Chazal, we're metaken that the husband gets the produce of this property. Where did they say he gets the produce of this property? Where he worked hard for the produce. Doesn't say that. So as long as he got the property before we picked the fruit, it's his. That's the machlokas. Now, Rabbi Shimon says, because this is a little bit, you'd think it's a little bit strange that we're giving him straight out the schus to something that, I mean, he wasn't tereyachin at all, but you should know that there's a mirror image over here in terms of the rights, because there are rights coming in, which the Baal gets, but there's also rights going out, if she's divorced, which the woman gets. And we balance out this little game. Because Bakom Shiyafekocho Beknisata, Hurakocho Bietziata. You should know that where we have given him a little bit extra on the way in, we're going to give her extra on the way out in exactly that same area, as we'll explain in a moment. And Bakom Shurakocho Beknisata, where he's losing out, where she's Nechneset, so then he wins when she's being divorced. What do I mean? Ketzat. Look. Perota Mechubarim Lekarka. If you have perot that are attached to the ground, we just said, according to Chachamim, that b'knisata, they go to him. Why does he have a right to such perot? What did he do for these perot? So you should know that b'yetzayata, shalom. Even though he spent a year working on these pears, but they're still attached to the ground, and now it comes along a divorce, he cannot say, look, I've worked so hard, I get my pears back, right? Because we say, well, that's nothing to do with your work, does it, sir? Because when she came into this marriage, you went ahead and you took the perot even though you didn't work on the perot. So we consider that to be your schus. So on the way out, we consider anything that hasn't been actually harvested to be hers. Same way we gave it to you on the way in. It's only fair, right? And on the other hand, that's Lushim Minat Karka. That which had been basically cash, they were already harvested, we no longer see them as the pirot of this karka, we see them only as a different form of cash. So in the case between Sata, who did they belong to? They belonged to her. He didn't have any schus in it. So there be it siyato, once he already harvested the pirot, but he still hasn't sold them or anything. So now at the divorce, she says, well, I mean, there's a whole storage full of $100,000 worth of pirot that's being shipped off next week. I should get that. He said to her, no, that actually is his. Because he already harvested it. So once he collected, he was okay in the money. So be it siyata, it's shalom.
Is rent called perot?
Yeah. Rent is called perot. As a matter of fact, that's our next question. Pshita, if they're arguing about what to buy. So one of them wants to buy karka, and actual karka, and one of them wants to buy houses to rent out. Exactly this case that our president raised. So if the question over here is are ubate, then certainly we could force the buying of ara, because she says, look, I want something that's not gonna end up going down in price. Remember that in the time of the Gemara, prices were basically stable, except for punctuations. But that's why the Mishnah bothers giving us amounts, monetary values, for what it is that's supposed to be produced and things like that all the time. Right, and we are forced to translate those things now into monetary values at the time, which ends up being very confusing because of inflation and other changes. Things don't seem to maintain any kind of realistic value. So the main problem with purchasing in those days, you didn't buy in order to play with the real estate market values, because there wasn't that much change. You didn't buy a house thinking that the value of the house is going to go up. You bought a house thinking about the income it can generate. But when you think about the income it can generate, you also have to factor in the cost of depreciation of the house. And you can't say, well, but the depreciation is more than made up for by the market rise. There was no market rise. So therefore, in this case, either of them can taina, look, the Baal could say, I'm not interested in safe investments. I'm interested in generating a lot of money. Okay, I'm willing to put in the work a farm, again, doesn't work nowadays, but a farm will generate more money than rent on the house. So let me buy karka, so you could say. She could say, on the other hand, I want something that's not going to be kalya karna, not something I don't have to worry about. So either of them now would have a taina to say what it is that they want. So therefore comes along the Gemara to be kodeya, that the din is ara, that we buy indeed land over here, because the land, the husband is saying, it generates more money. Or, in the other case where she's the one who wants the land, she is saying it's a safer investment because we don't have to worry about ultimate depreciation. I'm going to end up without that house. You're buying a house. What good is it going to do me? In 20 years, the house is going to have to be torn down. So, Mamela, either of them in that case can be Mamakit, and we can buy the Ara. If you have a choice between now, Bati Vedikli. Again, this is all local kind of things, right? So the big cash cow in those days were the Kohen. I mean, there's still countries in which you buy things with the kohen. Palm trees, big palm trees. When it comes to houses, I mean, houses certainly have less depreciation than palm trees that get used up. That's for sure. So if they're arguing about bote and dikle, over there the din is to buy a bayit. Dikle v'ilani, if it's between a dekel and other trees, so then clearly dikle, because the dikle is more profitable. Ilani the gufni. Now the problem is that gifanim are very, very vulnerable. So even though they generate a lot of money, but it's easy to lose a gifan. And so if it's a question of ilani, the gufni, we go for the ilani, once again, because it's a safer investment. A woman who brings in an abas ardata, or perot de kavin, how about something which, it's not that there are no perot at all, but zardata is really not, zardata are like these tiny animals. They're like a Chinese apple kind of thing, where the fruit itself is not very, ozardin, the fruit itself is not very useful. So the main thing that this thing is used for is the actual wood. So it's a wood forest, an apple is a forest. So it's a wood forest, or how about a fish pond? The problem over here is that once you've used up the fish, they tend not to come back again unless you restock them. Right, so in other words, irrational dagim is equivalent to say half irrational dagim, so to speak. So we call it pira de kavin. So that's called pira. The amre la karna. So the question over here is, the etzem, when you use it up, it's going to be mechalya karna. I mean, you use this thing up once, and that's it. So if she's going to take the dagim, where are the other dagim going to come from? So in this case, even though, as our president pointed out, there is karka, Do we look at the underlying karka? I mean, obviously, under this palm, there's land on which it's standing. So is the land the karen, or do we look at this essentially as the fish pond? Do we look at the forest as the forest? So over here, we have a machlokas. Some say that, indeed, we take a look at it as peiros, because we consider the land to be the ikar. Others say that, no, this is the ikar karen. Kalola de Milsa, generally, the rule is, according to this latter approach, that yizom machlif peira in yizom machlif karna. If you have something which does not generate, does not regenerate itself, then that is karen. If it regenerates itself, so then it's peiros. Omer Rabbi Zeir, Omer Rabbi Shai, Omer Rabbi Yanai, or some say it was Rabbi Abba, Omer Rabbi Shai, Omer Rabbi Yanai, Hagonev Vlad Behemat Melupa. Somebody steals a calf. Now the wife had brought in the behema. Mishalem Tashlume Kefel Leisha. Now at this point we think that that means that the Vlad is considered to be Karen and not Perot, and that therefore the woman is the one who owns the Vlad, not the husband. And if somebody steals the Vlad, therefore then he's chayev, as every ganav is Mishalem Kefel. So let him pay Kefel to the Isha. Now this is a little bit strange, because I mean, by definition, vladot are peirot. No, what's the difference between the pri of a tree and the pri of an animal? The only thing that maybe is different is that maybe the child is supposed to take the place of the parents, so therefore we view the coming generations not as peirot, but as sort of in lieu of the mother. But that, you see, problem is that is a big machlokas. And let's take a look at that. Kiman, says the Gemara. If you're telling me that you're Mishan Tashlume Kefel Isha, you seem to be arguing on both shitas in the following brisa. Lo kerabonan v'lo kechanan, the Tanya. V'lad be'emat melur lebal. V'lad shivchat melur le'isha. So we have over here a strange, that seems to be arbitrary distinction that's made by the Chachomim, that if a woman brings in a behemat melug into a marriage, so the child indeed is peirot and goes to the Baal. Masha'enkein, if a woman brings in a shifcha to a marriage, and that shifcha has a child, then it's not considered to be peirot, it's considered to be part of the keren le'isha. Which we're just going to explain later. Chananya ben Achi Yoshiomer, asu vlad shifchat melug, givlad behemat melug, there's no difference between them, a vlad goes to the Baal. But that means that if somebody steals it, who do they got to pay? They pay the Baal, not the Isha. And over here you're prosecuting that Vlad ben Azmalut, the Kefil goes to the Isha. So you're coming along to argue now on both Tanoim and the Brisa? How do you explain that? It says the Gemara, not true. If you misunderstand what I said. Afilu teima divrei hakol. This could be going like everybody, both Rabbanan and Chananya. I did not say that she gets the part of the Kefil that's the Karen. I said she gets the Kefil, and I meant the Kefil. Only the second part. So Enochinani, the value of the Vlad goes to the husband. The additional value of the Kefel, that goes to the woman. Ah, you'll say, why would that be? So why is that? Isn't the Kefel that a ganav pays, isn't that basically an income? And you're telling me the income goes to the husband, so then the Kefel should go to him too? I mean, it's sort of a strange type of income, but it's still a valid income. Somebody stole something, and now he was fined, so the fine is income. So why would the woman get that part of the money? I'll tell you why. Because pira takina le rabbana. Pira, the pira lo takina le rabbana. When we say that a Baal owns perot, don't mistake that to mean that the Baal has an actual schus in the kinyan of the perot. It's not true. He has a right to eat the perots. But it doesn't extend to giving him the type of baalut that you would normally get in terms of a kinyan perot. It's just a right to eat. We only gave him the right to eat the perots. We did not give him the right for that which those pears generate. Tosfos explains, accidental generate. Obviously, if he plants those pears, he gets the pears of those pears. That's not what it means. But over here, something that comes out of the blue. A guy stole it, now there's money coming in from the pharaoh. That wasn't given to the husband. That was the chiddush. So that even though the husband keeps the half of the kefal, the Karen part of the kefal, he keeps because that's connected his peirot, but the additional fine that's generated, which is 100% profit, that goes to the woman because it's not part of the normal money that's generated by peirot. So therefore, peirot, the peirot, lo takin le rabbanan. Okay, but can we just, I just want to understand the machlokas. I mean, at least Chananya is consistent, right? Chananya is saying that a vlad of a human or a vlad of an animal is exactly the same, which makes sense. I mean, you want to consider it like peirot, so consider it like peirot. The only reason not to consider it like peirot is, as we mentioned earlier, something that has a tendency to pass away, as human beings do and animals do. So we say that which is generated by that organism is meant to take the place of the original organism. Third, so if a woman brings in a cow, so then it would be understood that the vlad is not just a free of the cow, because the vlad is meant to take the place of the mother when the mother dies. So the same thing would be in a shifcha. If a shifcha is going to die, so I want to have that which the shifcha generates to take the place of the shifcha. So Hananya is going to say that we don't think about it in those terms. In other words, limita lo chashina. We don't think about the coming death of the cow or the coming death of the shifcha. We take things as they are. Chazal were mitakin that a woman who has property that was not estimated in the ketubah, and that the husband cannot guarantee a particular money value for what she brought in the ketubah, that is called nitzei melug. And what is done with nitzei melug is that we preserve the principle for the woman, and anything that is generated by that principle is now eaten by the husband. In a case where the principle is endangered, such as a woman brings in cash, and now if we would apply blindly the rule that the principal belongs to her and the generated value belongs to the husband, we will be taking a great chance for the woman's principal if we invest it in a business. Because since the husband is not responsible for the principal, he just doesn't have the rights to the principal, we want to ensure a woman's security by saying, look, you can't invest in risky things. You have to invest in solid things. Therefore, buy real estate. That's what we say. Where the woman, however, has already brought in a profit-generating keren, as opposed to cash, which simply tends to sit there like an exercise bike when it isn't used, and you don't lose weight just because the exercise bike is in your house, and you don't generate money just because the cash is under your mattress, right? So there, we got to decide, okay, cash, what are we going to do with the cash? But when the woman brings in cattle, we don't have to decide what are we going to do with these cattle. We're going to feed them, and they're going to generate babies. And then the Baal is going to have babies, and he's going to make money. Unless you tell me that something that regenerates itself, such as living organisms that regenerate themselves by having other living organisms, are basically just trade-offs, one organism for another. In order to say that, I would have to say that something which is looked at as just a biological, from a genetic point of view, it's just simply a biological alternative. Parent, child, parent, child, parent, child. So therefore, it's the same cattle. What's the nafkamina if it's the mother or the child? Hananya obviously doesn't hold like that. Hananya says, look, as long as something has a generally accepted lifetime of value, despite the fact that it's known to die, we don't look at the fact that it's known to die. But there's certainly no question in our mind that something that generates value is not called a cash. It's called a keren that is generating value. Right? I won't buy it because it's risky. But if she has it, the question that we have to deal with now is, what do we do with the money generated? In this case, with the children that are generated, right? When people invest in a farm of livestock, a chicken farm, and so on and so forth, they analyze the depreciation of the cattle the way you analyze the depreciation of a house. But we don't take a look at the money that the house generates as basically being the equivalent of another house. So let's set aside that money so we can buy another house with that money. That's not how we look at it, correct? We look at it as a cash-generating business that has depreciation. So there's two ways of understanding living organisms. Shall we treat them as businesses with depreciation, or shall we treat them the way nature treats them, as replicating things that replace themselves? That's a machlokas. So according to Hananya, we treat the cattle like a house that's depreciating. A house depreciates, a body depreciates. Fine. But there's also money that's being generated at the same time as depreciation. The meaning of nitzei melug is that the husband does not take responsibility for depreciation. That's by definition, nitzei melug. Nitzei tzon barzel, the husband takes responsibility for the depreciation. But then he has completely different rights of use. He can invest in whatever he wants. She'll say, but that's a horrible investment. And he'll say, so what do you care, baby? It's already, its value is written up in the ketuvah. I can do whatever the heck I want with it, as long as I guarantee you that you're going to get it back. So I guarantee you. But in this case, he doesn't have responsibilities for the keren. He has responsibilities for the cash generated. So now the question is, do we view living organisms as cash-generating machines, or do we view them as replicating mechanisms that are themselves? So Hananya obviously views cattle as a cash-generating machine. So in the same way, he views a human organism as a cash-generating machine. A shifcha reproduces. There's now another shifcha that are died or replaced. It's either or. Either they're never replaced because they're just depreciating, or anything that's there is held as replacement. Is that we're going to analyze how many there are and so on? Is that we view it as a shashlamisa? Is this considered to be keren with peros, or is it considered to be a keren that has a tendency to maintain its value? Right? very fundamental question. So Hananya clearly holds that this is a cash-generating keren, which the way we put that is that what he's saying is essentially, I don't worry about the death of the depreciation, that is to say, of the parent. So lo chai shen el mita. But according to the Rabbanan, you got to make up your mind. I chai shel mita afilu vlad beimat melug namilo. Look, if they hold that this is a replicating device, so then what's the difference if it's a shifres beimat melug? The husband should never get any of the pirot. Vlo chai shel mita afilu vlad shifrat melug nami. If they say, don't look this as a replicating device, look at it as a cash generator, so then the vlad of a shifres melug should also go to the Baal. And why are we saying over here vlad shifres melug goes to the isha? You have to be consistent. There's no difference in organisms between a human organism and a cow organism. So how are you going to explain me that difference? Says the Gemara, Liolam Chai Shelamita. There's no question that they are Chayish. But the point over here is that if we can identify a usable Karen that does not need to be replicated, then we will view whatever comes out of it as being Perot, generating. When an animal dies, is it worth something? Yes. That worth is the care. When a human dies, is it worth something? No. Then there's no care. That's the point. So if there's something that is going to be left now to the Isha of the Karen, that's the Karen. You say, but it depreciated. No, it depreciated. But when it comes to a Shifcha, it didn't depreciate, it disappeared. So if it disappeared, then we have to view it as replicating something in its place. It's a tremendous difference. We don't view bodies that are becoming older as depreciating. We view them as disappearing. That's the point. And it makes a great deal of sense to distinguish between those two things. It's wonderful. It's exciting. Okay. Right? Isn't that exciting? Come on, guys. So, shiny behema, the ika ora. When it comes to a behema, it's always worth something when it dies. Sell it for the skin. Make glue out of it. I don't care what you do with it, but it's worth money. There's nothing that isn't worth money. Omer Ravuna Barchia, Amar Shmuel, Halokha Kechananya. In point of fact, we view an organism, no matter what the case is, as something that is generating, and we view death as depreciation to zero in a human organism, depreciation to 1% in an animal, whatever it is. Omar Rava and Reb Nachman, look, Afagad the Omar Shmuel Afak Hananya. You may say that looks like Hananya, but you should know that Hananya is moda, that this is a unique case. Because in Nidgarsha, notena damim ve notalatan, v'peshevach v'taviyah. We have a special halacha, we'll see in many other cases we apply this thing, that where there is an emotional attachment to something, even though technically speaking its value level goes to the husband, its actual self does not go to the husband. Since over here this shivcha is still an emotional attachment to Beit Aviyah, and it expresses the chashivas of Beit Aviyah, so this is part of my inheritance from the great and rich home of whoever. Therefore, the Baal can't walk away with that. He can walk away with its value. But if she can replace the value, she gets the actual child of the shivcha. Because it's identifiable, and as identifiable, she's attached to it, and it means something to her. It gives her a leg to stand on in life, something to show off in life. So it's a tiferet.
She has to pay.
She has to pay. I own the money. Look, it's all very nice. I mean, I'd like to help you out, but I can't afford to give my newly divorced wife, you know, all of her emotional needs. So if you're paying me for it, fine. So then they'll force me to give it to you. Omar Rav Amar Nachman, Hichnisa lo eiz lechalba, v'rachel legizata, v'tarnegolet v'beitzata. The dekel leperotav. Look, there's all kinds of situations in which she goes ahead and she brings in things which the entire value of it is basically the things that it generates. So in all of these cases, he's able to eat it. So he eats all of the eggs of this tanagolot. And he drinks all of the milk of this eggs. And he eats all of the perot of this dekel. What's going to happen in the end? It's going to die. The deco will die, the age will die, the tanagolot will die. So you'll say, so isn't he using up the keren? Indeed, he continues to eat until there's nothing left. But that's because there's always something left, basically. Because if you're talking about the behema, we just said, there's always the R. If you're talking about a tanagolot, fill up a feather with its feathers, fill up a pillow. There's something of value that's left. The deco dies, sell it for firewood. So you can't say that it depreciates to zero, in which case it isn't literally Mechal Yakarna. Therefore, no matter how you look at it, these things are considered to be Perot, because they're constantly the Gizay Machlif. I take milk, more milk is generated. I take an egg, more egg is generated. I take off a date, more dates are generated. That is Perot. Omer of Nachman. By the way, some learn that over here the Nekuda is that it's Perot, but she was Machlif. was only something that she had right to, parents. That's how the Gemara is talking about. She didn't own the eis. She owned the eis for its peirot. So you would think that in that case, if the husband is taking the peirot, he's taking away what's hers. And that's the chiddush of the Gemara. Not that we're coming to tell me, oh, by the way, you should know that feathers are also sheur. What we're coming to say over here is that where what the woman has is peirot, those peirot go to the husband. We don't say, but then shouldn't we look at the peirot as a keren? No, the peirot were given as peirot without keren. So he gets the peirot also.
And when the animal dies?
She has nothing. She was never given the animal.
Right.
Someone gave her a schus to the peirot of the animal.
But I'm saying this issue that there's always 1% left isn't true.
Wouldn't be no gain, exactly. That's another way of learning the sugya. That's the tragedy. Hichniso lo eiz l'chalva, because that's all she had. So that's what she was machnas in. Not hichniso lo eiz l'chalva. What's saying? You should have said hichniso lo eiz. So he takes the chalva. Saying hichniso lo eiz l'chalva. It means that's what she brought in. She had an eiz l'chalva. So now the question of who gets that chalva. From the lashon, that's a very, very reasonable approach to the circuit.
Could it mean something else that there's a restriction? You can't check it for me. You have to keep it alive and only use it for milk.
That's a double question.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Omer Nachman. Ayala le gulima. So then, that's Paris. You have a beged. You keep wearing the beged. So mechasi bava azim adikalia. Because even when you use up the beged, there's still going to be some rags left from this beged. Keman ki haitana. What we're saying over here, basically, when Nachman is saying that the tiniest little bit is considered to be a keren that is left, it's like the following time. The tanya hamelach v'acho hareza perot. Somebody has a place that he owns on the edge of the Yam HaMelach, and he takes salt from it. And every time he takes salt, more water comes in, and more salt appears, and the water evaporates. So clearly that's considered to be perot. Somebody owns a piece of the beachfront, and he has sand, and builders buy sand from it. That's considered to be perot. And that's constantly regenerating. And so there's another form of perot. How about a pir shel gofrit, or a machporet shel tsarif? What would be the din? Somebody's got over here a mine that he takes sulfur out of, or he's got a mine in which he takes a dye of tsarif from. The Rabbi Meir omer keren, the chachamim omrim perot. Here says Rabbi Meir, these are not regenerating. Salt regenerates. The chol regenerates as new waves come into shore. But sulfur doesn't regenerate. So in that case, the whole value of it, what are you going to say? But, I mean, there's something left. You've got a hole in the ground. So the hole in the ground is worth something. But the point over here, so according to Rabbi Meir says, look, I mean, you're going to use up your sulfur. And if that's the case, you're going to have to buy property with the value of the sulfur. Whereas the Chachamim say, but the hole is also considered to be keren. It's worth something, so that will be the keren. And that means that he could continue to use up all of the sulfur, all the silver in the mine, whatever the case is, and they'll say, well, I'm leaving you the mine. So what am I going to do with a hole in the ground? I don't know, maybe someone will buy it for nuclear waste one day. Well, who knows? Meanwhile, I want to eat the peres. So you see over here that any type of shiur is considered to be a usable shiur. So if that's the case, right, by glima as well. Mashainkin, when you're talking about money, you're talking about cash, you're talking about peros, there's no shiur at all. It all goes into my tummy. So over there, that's considered to be hers for Karen. Rabbi Shimon Omer, makom shiyafek ocho. If he gets an additional value of Knisato, that's what the Tanakhama says. But Rabbi Shimon is simply saying Tanakhama, no? I mean, is he adding something? Is the Tanakhama arguing? He's saying Rabbi Shimon Omer as if he's arguing. Rabbi Shimon is following the sheet of the Tanakhama that Peres and Rabbi Chuborim Lakarka are considered to belong to the Baal. Big Kiddush, but that's what he's saying. Omer Rava, yes. But where did the Tanakhama address what the din is in the case of divorce? There is a difference because apparently, according to the Chachamim, even though they didn't discuss this case, you're telling me Rabbi Shimon Omer that b'yitziyatah shallah, apparently the Tanakhama holds not like that. That what it is that grew is considered to be his thing. So they don't agree with what Rabbi Shimon is saying that b'yitziyatah shallah. Since he put in the work, he generated these pears, he has the right to go ahead and take it. As far as the other thing is concerned, that if he picked the Paris, they're considered to be his, it's unreasonable to say they would argue on that. I mean, up until what point? The guy has the Paris, he already took his cash out, so to speak, of his investment. So to say that that's what they were arguing with the Chachamim, that's very strange. That for sure they would be made that he was already safe. Suppose she now has property that is not really working very well and not very effective, so that they're not making as much money in the value of the work that they're doing as it costs to keep them going, At least that's the way the Yerushalmi is magnified the question over here. So then what to do is, yimachru, sell them, v'ilakach mehem karka, and buy land with it. Now the Ritva asks the obvious question. If they're not making enough money, they're not doing enough work that makes it worthwhile keeping them, who in the world would buy a white elephant? They're not worth anything. And so he answers that the point over here is that if they're just supposed to be standing there as gatemen or something like that, they're worth money for that. But for the people who are using them right now, the kind of work they need them to do, for instance, housework, or they need them to do baking work. So that work that they're capable of doing in their current state is not worth what it costs to keep them up. On the other hand, to look stately like a nice butler and something, so over there they would be worth something to somebody who needs that kind of thing. And there you would buy karka, and of course, v'huachil pirot, and the husband would now eat that which the karka produces. Reb Shimon ben Gamliel says, anything that a woman brings in that is uniquely identifiable should not be sold. So lo tymkor b'pnein shein shevach beit aviyah. There's no chiv. I mean, obviously, if she wants to, she can sell her. If he can sell, she agrees. But the point is that if she feels an emotional connection to this, because to her it stands for the old time, I mean, can you imagine Batman selling the butler? My God. So it stands for the old-time values of her family. So then, since the Shevach Beit Aviyah, we cannot force it to sell. Furthermore, Naflu la zeitim ukfanim zekidim. Suppose we have now old zeitim ukfanim that are no longer making fruit. So there too, yimachlu v'yelakach b'm karka v'hochel perot. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda omer lotim kor m'ptein shein Shevach Beit Aviyah. Even in that doesn't mean that this is a machlokas of your Rabbi Yehuda saying only one case and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel saying another case. I mean, even though it's a little strange, but basically the Tosfos Yom Tov explains that each one is just bringing what it is that he was makabel from his Rabbi. Although, by the way, there is another girsa over here, which is not Rabbi Yehuda, but rather Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel in the Seifa as well. So over here, although we could say, look, at least let's get the wood value out of them, she can say, listen, this is a vineyard, and people identify it as the old family vineyard from where I come. I don't want it to be sold. It says the Gemara, Omer Fkana Marav, Machlokas, the whole Machlokas between the Tanakh and Rabbi Yehuda when it comes to the vineyards, or the olive trees, is only where Shenaflu Besada Shela. So where she owns also the carcass over there, there's always going to be some remnant of this memory, and therefore it says Rabbi Yehuda that she can insist on keeping the vines there also. But, I mean, the vines are ultimately going to die, leaving nothing. So, Aval Besada Shena Shela, if she only owns the vines, she has no relationship to the land, so Divrei HaKol, even Rabbi Yehuda would be loaded in that case that the Baal can force them to sell when it's not worth anything, because Mishum Nekokal Yakarna, basically the Karen value just disappears, and there's no Shevach Beis Aviyah in a place where there's no Karen, because there's nothing she can point to hold on to. Maskeflo Rav Yosef, what are you talking about, says Rav Yosef? The first case is of Avadim Shvachot, where we had the Machlokas of Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim, where every over there certainly there's nothing going to be left of those Avadim Shvachot after they die. The Chisad Shena Sheladani, nonetheless, we see that there's still a Machlokas of Shimon Gamliel holds that she can be Ma'akiv to say Shevach Beit Aviyah. So you see, even when a place where something is going to disappear with Gamri, it's considered to be Shevach Beit Aviyah. So we must have quoted Rav Kana Marav wrong. Ela I itmar hachi itmar. What Rav must have said was the following. Rav Kana Marav, machlok, where do we find a machlok at Tanakh and Rav Yehuda only in a Seder She'ena Kolas Rabbanan? Hold over there. That since Lamaisa, Seder She'ena Shalaz, since Lamaisa, the field is not hers, so there's not so much Shevach Beit Aviyah on something that nothing is going to be left on. Whereas if it's a Seder She'elah, then even the Rabbanan are made to Rav Yehuda, that Divrei HaKol lo timkor lipnei Shevach Beit Aviyah. So the contrary is definitely some Shevach Beit Aviyah here. The question is whether there's enough to be ma'akev the Mechira.